the beginning of the Babylonian captivity and the destruction of the Templars. And by the way, we will not meet tomorrow. Our next meeting will be next Tuesday. Now, number C will be the second pope of the Babylonian captivity, John 22nd. John 22nd was pope from 1316 to 1334. You might say that his becoming pope was an accident. Most of the popes during this particular century were fairly young men. Many of them became popes in their 30s, or even some of them, when they died, were in their 40s. But the Clement, you remember, had moved the papacy, the headquarters, from Rome to Avignon, and was very much under the control of the King of France. He had three cardinals left in Rome who were supposed to be controlling Rome, though Rome was falling more and more into the hands of the fighting petty nobles of the city, as had been the situation two centuries before. And the people of Italy were very much disturbed about the papacy being removed from Rome. According to the theory, the only reason why he had to say that he was pope or head of the church was that he was the bishop of Rome. And here he was living in Avignon, in France, which in those days was a trip of at least a week, and probably more. Probably nearly a week by boat, and longer if he went by land. And so they were very much disturbed about it. And so when Clement died, the Italians demanded that they have an Italian for pope. The French had the majority in the cardinals, and they wanted a French pope, but they could not force it through without the danger of serious disruption. And so the discussions continued for 27 months before they succeeded in electing another pope. And finally, when they did, the only way they were able to do it, there were two things. One was they elected an old man, 72 years of age, who they thought probably wouldn't live long, and by that time they could get together and one side or the other be strong enough to elect the man they wanted. He was a cardinal bishop, and he was a French background. Dante had written to the conclave, begging them to elect an Italian pope. But the French influence was so strong that they did elect a Frenchman, and in order, though, to be elected, he had to make a promise. The Italian said, the pope is bishop of Rome, he should be in Rome. How can he be bishop of Rome and be living in Avignon? And so he made a solemn promise. He said, I will never mount an ass except to start on the road to Rome. And having given that solemn promise, they agreed, thinking that the papacy would be moved back to Rome. But he was an elderly man anyway, and he found other means of transportation. And to the surprise of everyone, he lived for 18 more years until he was 90. And he was the most vigorous of the popes at Avignon. He was the most conspicuous of the popes of the 14th century. Schaff says, though certainly not the most able or worthy one. He was a man of very restless disposition, and he kept the papal court in constant commotion. The Vatican archives preserve 59 volumes of his bulls and other writings. He had a high, squeaky voice. They hadn't really wanted him for pope, but there he was. And he was unable, as he knew, to do much against the King of France. His predecessor had been completely under the King of France's control, so he set to work to declare authority over the Emperor of Germany. And he had a long struggle with the Emperor of Germany, which went on for many years. And eventually, the Pope won out in this particular struggle. This particular emperor lost out, and the Pope favored gained control. But it took a long time, and in the course of that, the Franciscans largely took the side of the German emperor that John opposed. And some of these Franciscans were very able men, and in the course of the controversy, they wrote books which attacked the authority of the Pope very strongly. And some of these helped lay the groundwork for the Reformation. They were men who were recognized as real scholars and who criticized the idea that the Pope could thus interfere with the political rulers, and they were ready to attack him on other grounds if they could, and he was very ready to give them grounds on which to attack him, because he wanted to be not merely a politician, not merely an administrator, but he rather fancied himself as a theologian. And so he began making declarations on theology, and some of these declarations contradicted the established view. And so those who maintain the idea that the Pope is infallible have a rather difficult problem in connection with John 22nd. Yes?
Isn't that infallible rule only from
the no, it was much later than that. It was in 1870 when a so-called ecumenical council voted that the Pope are infallible. But the claim was not the Pope now becomes infallible. The claim was the Pope, by virtue of his office, is the infallible teacher of the Church. That was the claim. And since that time, since 1870, when that was adopted, the popes have been very, very careful not to make ex cathedra utterances. Since that time, I believe there have only been three cases on which they've made ex cathedra utterances, and those utterances have been very carefully stated. In fact, sometimes almost rather ambiguous. Like the last one that was given was about 10 years ago on the taking of the Virgin Mary to heaven. And some have held that the Virgin Mary, that her body was taken to heaven so she never died. Others have held that after her death, her body disappeared, having been taken to heaven. And if you doubt this, all you have to do is to go to the Vatican Museum. And there you can see pictures which were painted 400 years ago, which show the sarcophagus of the Virgin Mary with the disciples standing around it, opening it 3 days after she died. And they opened it up, and instead of her body there, they found it filled with roses. And you can even see the roses in the beautiful picture there. But as to whether that is what the Pope meant, which of the two he meant, he worded it in such a way that you can't tell. He says her body was taken to heaven. That's what he said. But whether before death or after death, he does not say. So the theologians can still differ over that in the Roman Church. But that's one of the three statements they've made. But since 1870, they label them ex cathedra. But before that, nobody ever thought of such a thing. And, of course, these ideas in the Roman Church, none of them have originated because the Pope decided to make something a doctrine. No Pope has ever had the claim that he could create doctrine. The Pope claims to be the interpreter of doctrine. He claims to pass on the tradition that has been passed on from the beginning. And the result is that these superstitions and these erroneous ideas which have become established in the Roman Church have all of them been advanced by various groups for a long time before they have received any sort of a papal sanction. And this idea that the Pope was infallible was something that gradually grew up. But in 1870, it wasn't from now on the Pope was infallible. It is the Pope is the infallible teacher. And Professor Dellinger of Germany, the greatest defender of the papacy in the last century, when the council met, said, you cannot simply change history this way. The popes have contradicted one another. He was the greatest defender before that. But he said, I cannot swallow something utterly contrary to fact like this. And as a result, he was excommunicated. And during the rest of his life, they kept trying to get him to agree to submit and come back into the Church. Because he had done as much for the defense of Roman Catholicism as perhaps any other three men put together in the 19th century from a scholarly viewpoint. But he never could bring his conscience to submit to that idea that the Pope had been infallible. And yesterday, Bishop Pike on the TV said that he had been educated in a Jesuit school, but he came to differ on a certain point. And he felt strongly they were wrong. And then when the Pope came out with a strong statement for it, he said, well, he says, it's infallibility. He says, if you make one error, he says, you can't hold to infallibility any longer. Well, logically, that is true. But as we have noticed, the popes have made many errors through the years. But one of them, whom the defenders of infallibility have special difficulty in defending, is this John 22nd. Because he fancied himself a theologian, and he really was not a particularly deep thinker nor a particularly wide reader, but he was a fluent writer, and he wrote extensively. And before he became pope, he had written a book on the beatific vision, the vision of God which the souls of the blessed see. And he said in this book that those who die in the Lord, the blessed dead. Now, of course, they don't dismiss their money like that, because according to their view, the great bulk of people have to spend many years in purgatory. But there are a few who go direct to heaven, and according to their view, those who go to purgatory after a certain length of time can go to heaven. And of course, they don't know how long that will be. The popes have announced that if you perform a certain act of penance, if you do a certain thing, if you go to a certain church on a certain day, many such things as that, you will receive a remission of 3 weeks from purgatory, or 2 years, or something like that. You will get out of purgatory that much sooner. But how long the time you must spend in purgatory anyway is to be, nobody has ever said. So to subtract a certain amount from an unspecified total is rather difficult to figure mathematically. But vision of course, Paul, the Apostle Paul, said, to me to die is Christ. It certainly is a clear teaching of the New Testament that immediately upon death, those who are saved go to be with Christ. And of course, they actually see God in so far as anyone can be said to see God. They have what we call the beatific vision immediately upon death. That's the clear teaching of the New Testament. And the clear teaching of the New Testament is that all who die trusting in Christ go immediately to be with Christ. There is no purgatory, of course, according to the New Testament. But John wrote this book, as McSorley expresses in his Roman Catholic history, before he became pope. He wrote the book in which he made this statement. What McSorley does not stress here is the fact that when the Franciscans began to attack him and to accuse him of heresy and to demand that he be removed as pope and another pope be put in because he was a heretic for having written this false view, then Pope John proceeded to preach on him and to present his view in German in Avignon, that they would not have the vision of God until after the last judgment, that it would not come immediately after death for innocence. That was the view he presented, and it's so patently contrary to the teaching of many passages of the New Testament that his enemies were in a very easy position. And the emperor, whom he was strongly opposing at this time, urged the cardinals to summon a general council to condemn the Pope. And then in 1333, an assembly of theologians of Paris, as McSorley says, affirmed the opinion opposed to John's teaching and asked John to confirm their view. Now McSorley here, who is trying to defend the Roman view right down the line, says, in the consistory of 1534, the Pope declared he had not intended to define Catholic doctrine. He declared he had not intended to define Catholic doctrine when he preached certain views and presented them and declared they were the fact. McSorley goes on to say, and later he entirely refuted his former opinion, declaring himself in agreement with the Paris theologians. If he did that, it must have been on his deathbed. He never did it in writing. But John 22nd makes a real problem this way for the defenders of the idea that the popes have been infallible in their spiritual and religious teaching. Now, John 22nd is famous for another thing. The previous pope had, of course, abetted the King of France had given orders, which fit with the King of France's idea, that the Dyke Templars should be destroyed, and a great part of their wealth taken over by the King of France. Most writers declare that Clement V did this unwillingly, and that he tried to keep the Templars from being condemned. But the fact is that hundreds of them were tortured, and dozens of them were burned at the stake, and all of their wealth was seized, and a great part of it came to the hands of the King of France. And Clement V lived in luxury in Avignon and received tremendous revenues, but spent them very freely. But John 22nd was a better financial manager than Clement V had been. Although at the end of his 18-year reign, when he came to die, tremendous revenues had been received. He'd been constantly finding new ways to increase them. He would leave a bishopric empty for 2 or 3 years and order the income for it, and for the support it, to be sent to the papal headquarters. He would charge high fees for giving the symbols of office, and he would find excuses to remove men in order to get new fees with others. And when he died, his personal fortune was found to include a good many millions of dollars which he had accumulated. And so he is well known for this, as well as for his what they considered his heresy. I would say, as far as that point is concerned, he certainly was wrong. But there are many who have not thought that point too sufficiently. He was not so much on that point an enemy as he was simply one who was ignorant and careless. But it certainly is a real problem for the defenders of infallibility. Now, that was C. As D, we will look at the Pope of the rest of the Babylonian captivity. The popes of the rest of the Babylonian captivity. During the remainder of the 68 years that the papacy remained at Avignon, the Pope purchased the land there and built a tremendous palace occupying about an acre and a half. The building, I understand, is still in use, partly for political uses and partly for church use. Built this tremendous palace, and the Avignon Pope seems to have been discouraged by John XXII's inability to exert his will over the emperor, and not to have tried nearly so hard to control political events in Europe as to amass money for their own luxuries and their own pleasures. Some of the writers of the time expressed amazement that archbishops who had been considered as worthy and upright men as becoming popes immediately became playboys and lovers of luxury and all sorts of pleasures, legitimate and wrong. And writers like Petrarch, the other great writers of the century, describe the city of Avignon as one vast brothel, they say, a great center of iniquity. Meanwhile, there were difficulties with some of the nations which were sending in their great sums of money for this purpose and of supporting the papal court. And in Rome, there were difficulties because the city of Rome was degenerating with the fighting of the various local families that possessed a certain amount of means. Some of you may have read the rather famous historical novel, The Last Days of Pompeii, by Bulwer Lytton. Bulwer Lytton wrote a great many novels. And he's, of course, not a novelist in the class of Dickens and Thackeray, who were his contemporaries, but he was at about these things. He was a contemporary of theirs, and if those very great men had not been at the time, he probably would be considered as one of the very outstanding men. His novels were very widely read and very highly thought of at the time. He probably wrote too many of them to have really high quality. But there is a novel he wrote called Rienzi, a historical novel, which I read when I was in Rome in 1912, and was greatly impressed with, in fact, more than I've been impressed by The Last Days of Pompeii. And Rienzi was a local Roman whose brother was killed when, as an innocent bystander, when the forces of two of these Roman nobles happened to meet in the street and began fighting with each other, and Rienzi tried to rouse the people of Rome to establish their freedom from the fighting of these petty, brutal nobles who controlled the city while the popes were off in Ravenna. Eventually, Rienzi himself lost his life there. But the story gives a vivid story of a man who, at least according to the story, was a man of considerable high quality. And it gives an idea of the condition into which Rome was sinking at this time when nominally the spiritual center of the world, actually the papal power was entirely in Ravenna, and Rome was the prey of the petty nobles of the city. And so the people of Italy, many of them were constantly demanding that the papacy be taken back to Italy during these years. Also, there came a difficulty with England, because the King John of England, when the nobles forced him to sign the Magna Carta, he tried to get out of it by simply turning his realm over to the Pope and declaring himself a vassal of the Pope. And the Pope had demanded tribute from England, which was, he said, was a part of his domain as a result of what John had done, but neither the English people nor the succeeding kings recognized. And this came to a head during this time at Avignon when the English King Edward III sent a representation to Avignon to try to get this matter straightened out. And on the representation, he sent one of the leading scholars of England, a man named John Wycliffe. And John Wycliffe came to Avignon representing the King of England in this embassy and got a first-hand look at the headquarters of the Pope in Avignon. And this probably helped in preparing the way for Wycliffe's later activities. He is known as the Morning Star of the Reformation, and we will look at him more in detail a little later. I just mention him here as we're surveying this part of the papal activity. Eventually, one of the popes was urged by a woman from Sweden, whom the Romanists call a saint, Saint Bridget of Sweden. She urged him to move the papacy back to Italy, and he considered it very seriously. She claimed she had had visions that told her that it should go back. And then a woman from Italy, who they call Saint Catherine of Siena, came to see the Pope and begged him to go back to Rome, and he gave in to her strong request and moved the papacy back to Rome in 1378. He died almost immediately after he moved back. But that brought the end of the Babylonian captivity, so-called, of the papacy. Then that was D, then E, the beginning of the Great Schism. The beginning of the Great Schism. When Pope Gregory XI died in 1378, and he had moved his headquarters back to Rome, but had just come there, the cardinals immediately met to elect the new pope, and by this time, the Roman people, after rejoicing that the papacy had come back and that there would be some authority in town, stronger than these fighting nobles or brutal leaders of very almost banditti, you'd almost call them, from the way they were behaving, they were glad to have some better authority there in Rome. Now they wanted to have the pope actually be a Roman. And of course, the people of Italy were demanding he be an Italian. Most of these Avignon popes were French. And so they say that the meeting was a very difficult one of the cardinals, because all around were the people yelling, "Give us a Roman pope! Give us an Italian for pope! Hurry up and give us a pope, a new pope!" And the cardinals couldn't agree. The French cardinals wanted to elect a Frenchman who would move them, the papacy back to Avignon. And the Italian cardinals wanted to elect an Italian who would keep us there, and while they were arguing about it, the people outside were yelling, and the cardinals began to fear for their lives. So under the pressure of the yelling outside, they decided to elect a man who was not present with them that day, an Italian, but not a Roman. And so when they elected this man, then the people outside were yelling, "Give us a Roman," and they decided to for fear of their life, to stay the law for a little time. So there was a cardinal who belonged to one of these two families that are so prominent in the story of Rienzi, a family called the Orsini family. There was a very elderly cardinal in this family. And so they put the papal robes on him. And they opened the doors and they said, "We've chosen the Pope," and they pointed to him. And the people began to kneel in front of him, and the people began to yell, "Isn't this wonderful? We now have a Roman for Pope." And according to what some say was the custom of that day, they went to his home and broke into it and looted it, which they usually did with the man who had become the Pope at that time. But the next day, the man they had elected, who was the Archbishop of another area, who had a high reputation for being a man of upright life and character, arrived. And now they announced, "You have a Pope now." They said, "We have a Pope, and he has taken the name of Urban VI. And so Urban VI was made the new Pope. He was an Italian. He was a man who was considered as a man of upright character, but he was a man who had absolutely no idea of tact whatever. If Urban VI had been a man of real tact, he would have had a difficult problem, because the majority of the cardinals still were French and didn't want to stay there, wanted to go to Avignon. And the cardinals, during the long time in the Babylonian captivity in Avignon, the church had degenerated as far as its morals were concerned, and as its seeking for personal advantage, for money for the individuals and for their families. And a man who wanted to have things on a decent moral basis and would have a difficult job if he handled people with tact. But tact was something that Urban VI had never heard. And so he began addressing the cardinals and telling them that they had to change their lives from their vile lives and manners. And he slapped some of them in the face, and some of them he threatened with execution. And the cardinals, one or two were put in prison by him, but the others found excuses to get out of the city. And they moved back to France, and there they announced that they had elected Urban VI through fear of their lives on account of the mob outside. Actually, he did not represent their election. And so the cardinals, who had declared that they unanimously elected Urban VI, now declared that they unanimously elected a different man, a Frenchman. And this was a man who was considered to be of rather high character, quite different from the previous Avignon Pope. And in addition to that, he was a man of very considerable tact. And so now you have a period of about 30 years in which you start in with two popes. And then after a brief time, people find it impossible, because some nations recognize one pope, some recognize the other pope, and some are changing from one to the other, and it becomes a very difficult situation. So some of the cardinals of both popes got together and said, "Let's do away with both of them and get a united situation again." And they chose a new pope whom the others didn't recognize. And the result is now you had three popes. And it's very interesting, a book written by a nun that I have at home on church history, Visualized, which has accounts of various events in church history and pictures illustrating. And here, it shows a picture of three men, each of them with a papal crown on his head, each of them with a papal garment. The three men stand there, and each of them claiming to be the Pope, to be the head of the Christian church on earth. And then below it says, which is the true Pope? How can we tell? And then the answer is given. See, one of them has a dove above his head. That is the Holy Spirit. He's saying, this is the true Pope. And the picture has more wisdom in it than the nun realized when she put it in her book, I'm sure. Because the only way you can tell who is qualified to be a true leader in Christ's church is not to see who has been elected by some group of people or who has gone through certain formalities, but to see who the Holy Spirit really is using. The only trouble is, to people who are not spiritual, the evidence of that is not clear. And the Roman Catholics, of course, consider that for spiritual evidence, one of the finest is to see what saints, what various saints have held, people who are recognized in the church as saints. But the problem here is that there were people of high character, like this Catherine of Siena we just mentioned, and Bridget of Sweden. There were people who, on account of their character and their devotion, were considered in their lifetime as real saints, and who have been venerated since as saints, who recognize each one of the three. And so that on that basis, it is very hard for the Roman Church to throw out any one of the three. And so they have had to go back to a claim of a matter of technical legality. And in order to do that, they say Urban VI in Rome was elected by the cardinals by a unanimous vote. And therefore, he is the true Pope. And so that is the view that the Roman Church holds today. But during the centuries, there has been great variation of opinion on it, because the Avignon Pope, for the next few years, had somewhat more power than the Roman line of popes had. And they were certainly far more tactful people, and there probably was not a great deal of difference in the character of the two groups. And then when the cardinals got together, it was the other. And of course, the Avignon popes can make a very good argument, because the popes say, we were forced into this through fear of our lives, and as soon as we got away from the Roman mob, there we acted, and the same cardinal who had elected Urban VI unanimously elected the other man who became the Avignon Pope. Mr. Hoover, you had a question? Urban VI stayed in Rome, and the one in France called himself Clement VII, and they now call him Anti-Pope. But McSorley lists all those who claim to be popes, like him, whom he calls Anti-Pope. Just as after John 22nd, he lists Nicholas V, Anti-Pope, a man who the emperor tried to make pope in place of John 22nd. How this situation, which was very unsatisfactory from every viewpoint, how this was worked out doesn't come till the beginning of the next century. But it has many implications in various areas of our church history, and we will look at it in connection with the beginning of that century. Now, with this survey now of the papacy during this period, which we call A.D. A and E, we now go back to the very beginning of the century again to look at a different sort of thing. In fact, we go back before the beginning of the century, because the man of whom I wish now to speak is a man who lived most of his life in the previous century. But he did live for a number of years in this century, and so I decided this year to discuss him under the 14th century instead of under the 13th century, as I did when we went through his court last time. This man, who is partly in the one century and partly in the other, is a great relief after surveying the history of these various popes, because he was a man who showed the working of the Spirit of God in certain remarkable ways, and who also showed an intelligent mind trying, with the best light available to him at that time, to make his life count for what he thought was right. And so he is a man who is not greatly known, though he is always mentioned in any description of the great men of those centuries. And he is generally considered one of the scholastics, of the 13th century, but actually he is quite different from Martha. Well, not quite as different, perhaps, as Roger Bacon was, whom we mentioned among them, but different, very different, in a different way from Roger Bacon. This man's name is Raymond Lull, L-U-L-L, sometimes written as Lully, with a Y at the end. See, these men are apt to write their names in different languages, in various languages, and often the spelling varies in the different languages. But this Raymond Lull is a man of a very interesting life, and a life that I teach us today. Raymond Lull was a man from a wealthy Spanish family from the island of Mallorca off the coast of Spain. A man who became one of the leaders in the administration of the court of the king of the rule over a large part of Spain at that time. And Raymond Lull, born in 1232, died in 1315, was, as a young man, devoted to the pleasures and luxuries which were characteristic of the life of the time. And when he was about 30, he was writing poetry to various women of the court, and often rather licentious poetry. And as he was writing some verses one day, he felt as if he looked up from his writing and as if he saw on the window, as if it was a picture there, he saw Christ crucified. And the thought came to him, if he was willing to give his life for me, to save me from hell, and to make me righteous, what am I doing in this sort of thing? He had two or three experiences like this. And then there was a woman whom he was pursuing, who had impressed him as a very, very attractive woman, and whom he went to see, and he found that she had a loathsome disease, which, when he came to see, a big cancer on her breast, I believe it was, but when he came to see it, he said, how I see here, how the things that look so attractive and so beautiful and so wonderful in this world, when you get to see what they really are often loathsome and worthless. And the only thing that is worthwhile is trying to do something for the one who did so much for us. And so he forsook all of his luxury. He did not, like St. Francis, attempt to go into a life of poverty. Instead, he determined to devote everything that he had to trying to serve the Lord who had given his life to save him from hell. And he was aware of the great activity of the Crusades and the number of soldiers who went off to fight against the Muslims to try to secure by force possession of Jerusalem. And Lull said, what is more desirable in the eyes of the Lord? That Christians should have possession of a certain plot of ground, or that the souls of these Muslims should be saved and that they should be brought to the knowledge of Christ? And so he purchased a slave who had been captured, a Muslim who had been captured and who was a slave, he purchased, and set to work to try to learn Arabic from him. And the man was a rather difficult man to get along with, but Francis worked very hard to try to learn from him and eventually made a real friend of him and eventually learned Arabic from him. It took him 8 or 10 years under the difficulty because there was no place he could go then to learn Arabic. But he learned it well in order that he might go to be an instrument to try to win the Muslims for Christ. And then he said, how are we going to present Christianity to the Muslims? He said, and he studied the matter of how to present Christianity to Muslims, and in thinking of that, he thought, how shall we present Christianity to people here in Europe? And he worked out a system which he thought would make it easy to show that Christianity was true. He worked out various diagrams, various systems which some people have made much, have ridiculed much, have made fun of. McSorley says, Raymond denied the distinction between reason and faith and undertook to demonstrate the supernatural mysteries of logic through the use of his so-called ars magna. His system of mystic rationalism was popular for a while at the universities of Barcelona and Valencia, but it was condemned by Gregory XI in 1376. He doesn't mention the fact that though it was condemned and his books were placed on the index, others examining it later said there's no reason to condemn it. There's nothing in it which in any way contradicts the Bible. He perhaps goes beyond what we can go in saying that we can prove the great central doctrines of Christianity by simple logic. Much of it we know simply because God has revealed it. But it certainly is true that Christianity is in no sense contrary to true logic or contrary to true reason. And he set out to prove it. Now he had two great ambitions. His first, one of these ambitions was to get chairs of Arabic and Hebrew established in European universities so that people might be trained to deal with the Muslims on a reasonable basis and to show them the truth of Christianity. The other was to lead people to actually go to the Muslims, not as crusaders to fight them, but as missionaries to present the truth to them. And Lully didn't simply talk about this, he set to work to do it. And so in 1291, when he felt that he was ready, he had done some teaching in Paris, he had been urging the raising of interest in the language and the views of the Muslims in order to meet them. In 1291, when he was 58 years of age, he went to North Africa. And there in North Africa, he went into the public square and he put up his large chart and began to speak publicly and to declare that the Muslim religion, while it had certain great truths in it about the fact that there is only one God and that there's going to be a great judgment and other great truths, that it was incomplete and insufficient, and that it was necessary to truly understand God, to recognize the Trinity, to realize the true nature of God, and to realize the work of Christ. And he presented these matters in the public square and got a considerable crowd around him and a number of people who were impressed by what he said, and some seemed to be on the point of accepting his views when word came to the rulers, and they seized him and put him in prison. And they immediately sent some of the leading Muslim scholars to talk with him. They said, a man who has the courage to do this, and a man who has the brains to do this, the way that this man is doing it, they said, he would be a great force for Islam if we could show him what the truth is. And so they went to argue with him. What they found, that not only could they not convince him, some of them were unable to answer his argument. And they had sufficient respect for his views, or for his courage and for his general character, that they released him on condition he leave the country immediately. So he went back to Europe, and now he went about Europe urging that groups be started to train people to reach the Muslims for Christ, urging the establishment of the chairs of Arabic and Hebrew in the universities. He addressed a so-called ecumenical council at length on this subject, and he did succeed in getting such chairs established, but most people were too busy with other things to pay the attention that he desired to what he wanted done. And he went back again, and again came to North Africa, and there in the public square he presented his views, and he was attacked this time and left for dead. But a Christian merchant picked him up and took him off to his home and took care of him, and again he went back to Europe. And then, eventually, when he was about 80 years of age, he went back once more. And again he preached, and this time he was actually stoned to death in 1315. And so he is one of the true precursors of the modern missionary movement. His knowledge was, his understanding was not as complete in some ways as we might wish it was, and in some ways his theorizing was probably inaccurate. But when we consider the background and the situation, I think we have to have tremendous respect for the courage of the man and for his real devotion to Christ and his desire to make Christ known under very severe difficulty. It's very interesting that in spare time, he found time to write romances and poems in the Catalan dialect of Spanish, which are still considered thought of very highly. McSorley speaks of one of his works as one of the richest treasures of Catalonian literature. And many of his followers call him the Illuminated Doctor. He was, he is still, at least he was a few years ago, his memory is reverenced in the area of Spain from which he came, and there he is considered as a saint, though, as McSorley says, his erroneous teaching prevented his canonization. And so here is a man who has much to teach us and a wonderful example to set us of true loyalty to Christ and setting to work to bring every thought and every activity into submission to the best we can determine as to what is the will of Christ and how we can make Him known and spread the knowledge of Christ in the world. And we continue that tomorrow.